you're going to move now to appeal 25-1379. This is United States versus Brian Lewis. We're going to begin with oral argument from Ms. Green.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brianna Peterson Green of Shire and Ritchie, and I represent the defendant appellant Brian Lewis. Less than 2 weeks after Mr. Lewis's trial ended, his trial counsel, Christopher Amiro, filed three federal motions to withdraw in unrelated matters, saying his brain was so injured he could no longer practice law. Mr. Amiro had sustained a traumatic brain injury and suffered the psychological impacts of that condition during his representation of Mr. Lewis. The medical records support a finding that Mr. Amiro was not fit to practice law during the trial, and Mr. Amiro's filings support his belief that he was unfit to practice law. This case should be remanded because the trial court abused its discretion in failing to conduct an evidentiary hearing on claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, where the arguments were later substantiated by the medical records and reports detailing a history of treatment related to a traumatic brain injury that impacted trial counsel's memory and ability to practice law. Evidentiary hearing is essential in this case to resolve the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. We also raised three other issues that the trial court erred in denying motion under 33B2, 33B1, and in denying motion 29, motion for acquittal. Now, I'd like to start with the issue as it relates to the evidentiary hearing, because I do think that is the most pressing. It is our belief the district court erred by failing to conduct an evidentiary hearing on Mr. Lewis's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, because his arguments were later substantiated by medical records and reports detailing a history of treatment related to a traumatic brain injury. The district court scheduled an evidentiary hearing. They allowed us to engage in investigation and discovery efforts. That was when we discovered, 11 days before trial, Mr. Amiro had met with a medical professional and disclosed memory issues impacting his ability to practice law and his intent to close down his practice. Now, the district court did ultimately deny our motion for a new trial without an evidentiary hearing, as the motion was untimely. It is our belief that this was an abuse of discretion. Mr. Lewis should have been granted leave to file out of time. The evidentiary hearing was set. The parties were present. Mr. Amiro was set to testify. Mr. Lewis's arguments calling the course of Mr. Amiro's representation into question have been substantiated by the investigation that we were allowed to conduct.
Let's look at the timeliness issue if we do it somewhat piecemeal.
Sure.
If we go just to Rule 33B1, all right, for the newly discovered evidence. The newly discovered evidence, as I understand it, that Mr. Lewis is relying on is counsel's medical condition.
Correct.
All right. Let's start there.
Okay, so that's the first issue in the brief then. It is a little bit more of an unusual argument because we haven't really seen anything like this before, but this is where I said I raised the limited scope as to the constitutional issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. We're merely raising it as to this issue because, as O'Malley says, newly discovered evidence can rely on a constitutional theory. And here the constitutional theory is the ineffective assistance, and that new evidence was not available to Mr. Lewis at the time of his trial, and it wasn't available to the court either.
That evidence, though, would never be admissible with regard to either guilt or innocence.
Right, and so we didn't get into the exact details of the ineffective assistance because we do not want to waive it on a 2255, but we did raise it in our motion for a new trial with leave to file out of time, where we go into how it was very close to being a hung jury, and maybe if trial counsel had been fit, had the memory capabilities, and had conducted those inquiries that we will go into greater detail in a 2255, that we wouldn't be here today and he might have been acquitted. I know it is a bit of a stretch, but there's no way to know.
When you say, Ms. Green, that you want to pursue, you want to pursue the hearing and you want to pursue this under 33B1, and you refer to it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, do you think of it as a claim under Strickland versus Washington?
No, I would
And the reason I'm asking you that, okay, is because in your brief, you refer to what transpired in light of Mr. Amaro's head injuries. You refer to it as a complete denial of counsel on page 23, and then on page 24, you call this a claim of per se ineffective assistance. So that's not Strickland versus Washington, because as you know, Strickland versus Washington has a prejudice prong to it. Strickland does not establish a per se rule.
Right. Yeah. So I believe that we would presume under Kronick. We didn't go into great detail over the ineffective assistance, and I'd be happy to go into that more, but the presumption in Kronick is that counsel's assistance is essential and requires us to conclude that a trial is unfair if the accused is denied counsel at a critical stage of his trial. Only when
a Kronick claim is different from a Strickland claim.
Right. So here we're saying it would be like a presumption of ineffectiveness that we don't need to go into his actual performance at trial or into prejudice because his brain was impacted in such a way that we need an evidentiary hearing to go into what assessments he made before we can get into a Strickland analysis.
Okay, all right.
Did I cover the first issue, Your Honor?
I wanted to dive into B2 and whether or not there was excusable neglect.
Absolutely. So under B2, it was our belief that it is under excusable neglect. Now, I noticed in counsel's brief, there's a difference between excusable neglect for Mr. Amaro and excusable neglect for Mr. Shire and myself. Now, first for Mr. Amaro, I think excusable neglect is very clear here. He had a traumatic brain injury. He didn't speak to Mr. Lewis within the 14 days to file that motion for new trial. He didn't inform the court within that time period either. Now, it seems to be the most two important prongs are the length of delay and the reason for delay. Would you like me to address Mr. Miro's or just move straight to Mr. Shire's?
Yeah, I think it's fine. Go ahead and address those.
Okay, so for Mr. Miro, the length of delay, he was completely unavailable. Not until November 29th did Mr. Lewis file his pro se emergency motion. And then December 5th was when we had the status conference where Mr. Miro indicated that he was unfit to practice law. So the length of delay, Mr. Lewis is not an attorney. He could not have known that of that 14-day time period. Now, as for the length of delay for Mr. Shire, we entered our appearance February 6, 2024. And then transcripts became available about a week later for that December 5th hearing. Our motion for new trial and leave to file out of time was filed.
We're already beyond the 14 days, though.
It was beyond the 14 days. And so I think there are a couple different reasons why the excusable neglect argument is really important here, because I believe counsel brings up the Cates case. So in Cates, counsel in that case filed 2 months after the fact. It wasn't a detailed motion. It was merely a request for more time. At that time, they also requested transcripts. There wasn't specific allegations. There wasn't a specific timeline. He said that he had conducted an investigation and inquiry into the underlying claims, but at that time he was requesting transcripts. He couldn't have been reading the trial transcripts because they weren't available. Here it was about a month. We got transcripts for the trial before we entered, but we didn't get that December 5th hearing transcript until a week after we entered. And then our motion was not boilerplate. It was 22 pages. It was as thorough as we could be under the time constraint that we had. In Cates, they cite to, I believe, Munoz, where they discuss a case that excusable neglect was present. And unfortunately, in that case, the attorney did ask for a request for an extension of time within 5 days. And then 10 weeks later, they filed the detailed motion. Here, we're within the 10-week time frame. However, we did not request additional time. Perhaps it was our belief under the facts that initially the CJA-appointed counsel was given time to read the transcripts and understand the facts of what was going on. We assumed maybe the same thing extended to us. These are really unusual circumstances, and we were still trying to grapple with what was happening at the time.
Would you like to reserve the remainder of your time?
Yes, please, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Green. Mr. Simpson will now move to you on behalf of the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Scott Simpson on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about the standard of review here. I believe defense counsel said or acknowledged that the standard here is abuse of discretion, but counsel also referred to both Rule 33 and Rule 29, under which the court standard of review is de novo. We believe that the standard here should be abuse of discretion, which of course is the standard that this court normally uses in reviewing a district court's denial of a motion for new trial under Rule 33. Mr. Lewis's original motion was entitled Motion for New Trial and Leave to File Out of Time. He filed made three other filings thereafter in relation to the motion, and all of those filings cited only Rule 33 in his appellate briefs. Here have repeatedly called it a motion for new trial. So the standard here should be abuse of discretion. Still, ultimately, we don't think it matters what the standard of review is because the district court's ruling here should be upheld under any standard of review. So on the merits, and I'll talk about, of course, about Rule 33. There's a balance, of course, between finality and fairness. And the deadlines in Rule 33 and 5B1 and 5B2 reflect the Supreme Court's assessment of that balance in relation to a motion for new trial. Finality is especially important when you're talking about the parties having gone through a trial, having expended their resources for a trial, and the jury having spoken. So in this case, the usual 14-day time limit should apply rather than the 3-year time limit for a motion based on newly discovered evidence. Obviously, when you say the word evidence, you think of things that the jury would use to assess the defendant's guilt or innocence. That the court in a number of cases, for example, Ruth, Rollins, cases cited in our brief, this court has said that's what evidence means in Rule 33B1.
Sounds like Lewis is pursuing a chronic approach. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Your Honor, I almost started my argument just now by saying we are here on a motion, on a Rule 33 motion. I've handled before this court, of course, motions under Section 2255. We're here on our 33. We're here talking about the timeliness of the motion. They can, and presumably, I assume they will file a motion under Section 2255. But that's not what we're here on right now. We're here assessing whether the district court abused its discretion in finding that the motion was not timely.
Mr. Simpson, can I ask you a couple legal questions? You've got massive experience in our court. Are you asking us to hold, and it's a question about breadth, that's what I'm trying to get at. Are you asking us to hold that under 33B1, the extended time limit, that an ineffective assistance of counsel claim categorically cannot be pursued?
So let's see, maybe I'm getting confused. 33B1 is newly discovered evidence.
Correct, right. Correct. So are you saying that whether it's this fact pattern or any other that we sit around for the rest of the day and hypothesize, that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, a la Strickland versus Washington, can never fit within B1 because it's not a claim based on newly discovered evidence.
Yes, we are asking the court to rule that, Honor, Your Honor, and I think the correctness of that position is reflected in this court's precedent. As I mentioned, Ruth and Rollins talk about evidence under B1 being things that go to guilt or innocence. Now, the one case in which this court has gone beyond that is O'Malley. Of course, we recognize the correctness, we recognize the existence of that decision. But in O'Malley, the court kind of went just one step beyond that meaning, that understanding of evidence. In O'Malley, the information went to the accuracy of a key government witness's testimony on an element of the crime.
Yeah, I mean, Brady Giglio, that definitely bears upon evidence and outcome of trial.
It goes to, and let me, if I could just say, Your Honor, what I think, and I'll, my answer, what I'm going to say now will encompass an answer to that question, Your Honor. So what we believe this court's case law reflects in relation to what newly discovered evidence is,
yeah,
it can either be information that goes to guilt or innocence, or it can be information that affects the jury's acceptance of evidence, the jury's the weight of evidence, or the jury's admission of evidence going to guilt or innocence. So if there's a Brady or a Giglio, however you want to pronounce it, if there's a Brady or a Giglio violation, that would affect the acceptance, the court's acceptance of evidence. And when I say evidence, again, I mean information that goes to guilt or innocence. It does not include then, based on this court's case law, newly discovered evidence does not include information about defense counsel's mental fitness, which is what we have here, or our performance. That kind of thing, again, is something that the defendant could raise in a claim of ineffective assistance. And this court has said many times, going back to what I said earlier about 2255, this court has said many times that the proper vehicle for a claim of ineffective assistance is a motion under Section 2255. And that's appropriate. The court has said that many times. So again, we believe the 14-day time limit, under Rule B1 applies here.
Can I ask you a follow-up question?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to change the facts. Okay. And I want you to assume that the exact same motion was brought within 14 days under 33B2. Okay. Is the United States' position there that, well, if it's timely under B2, even though it's an ineffective assistance claim, and even though you're quite right to say that the law wants to channel, U.S. Supreme Court has said this, wants to channel ineffective assistance to 2255 in federal criminal law, that if it's brought within 14 days, it can be adjudicated?
Your Honor, that would be an interesting scenario, I would think. I can't
so see. What it would mean here would just be, so suppose, I don't remember the guy's name, Riney or Brian, some public defender that was in the...
Briney.
Okay. Briney. There was a public defender that, if the public defender had filed the exact same motion that Ms. Green and her colleague filed, right, then it might be within the 14 days that way. And that issue would be squarely before us. And the question I have then on that hypothetical, it's not the fact pattern, I know that, is would the United States be of a view that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, albeit in a very odd posture, could be adjudicated on the merits under the standard in 33A and the time period in B2?
Very strange situation. You would have I suppose it would be a different standard. Would it even be Strickland? I'm not sure. Wouldn't that be the standard under Rule 33? And I suppose if the district court did that, the district court would assess it under the Rule 33 standard, and this court perhaps would address it.
What concerns me about it is there's actually a pretty active circuit split on this. It's a 4-3 circuit split, so we're going to have to figure out where we go on it. Okay, but what concerns me about it is if the answer to the hypothetical is yes, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim can be adjudicated if it's brought within the 14 days. Okay, then what the criminal defendant is going to face is a predicament of one and only one shot at an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. It's very hard for me to envision a world where you say, well, I adjudicated the ineffective assistance of counsel claim under the B2 time period, but I now have a different one, another one that I want to pursue under 2255. Mm-hmm. So there's, in other words, that kind of, all of that channeling to 2255 can create a real predicament for a defendant that's insisting under B2 on the adjudication of the ineffective assistance claim within the 14-day period.
My understanding,
that's what I'm worried about.
My understanding of this court's case law, when the court says over and over that rule, that section 2255 is the correct vehicle for an ineffective assistance claim,
right.
I believe the main reason for that is that it's in a 2250 in the 2255 context, where the defendant can get the additional, can more easily get the additional factual development that would be needed for that ineffective assistance claim.
Based upon the waiver of the attorney-client privilege.
Correct, exactly. So I think if the district court were to have addressed it under Rule 33 in that kind of context, it would be somewhat limited. And this court would probably remind the district court that it needs to be under 2255. Because of the need for additional development in the record.
Well, ordinarily that is absolutely right, but here you have the oddity of counsel changing. So the counsel that is, on this fact pattern anyway, the counsel that is pursuing the Rule 33 relief is not trial counsel, right? Mr. Amaro withdrew. So then you have the public defender, and then you have Ms. Green's firm that steps in.
So that again goes to the excusable neglect, which I was going to go to next. If I could just kind of summarize the factual scenario here. So Mr. Amaro revealed his diagnosis about a month after trial. At that point, the court appointed Mr. Brining from the public defender's office. Mr. Brining represented the defendant for 2 months. In the middle of that period, it was actually in the middle of that two-month period when Mr. Brining represented him, that the trial transcripts became available. They were filed on the docket at that point. And Mr. Brining, during that two-month period, did not file a motion for new trial. Then Attorney Shearer comes in, makes his appearance, and did not file a motion for new trial for a month. So what we have there total is 4 months after trial. And kind of going back to what I said about fairness and finality, we submit that 4 month delay definitely does not serve finality, especially because, and this I think this may have been referred to already this morning, if Mr. Amaro's performance was inadequate, had been inadequate, deficient, that would have been, should have been evident during trial. Now, just to be clear, and I think this goes a little bit toward what you were asking, Judge Scudder. Just to be clear, the government is not relying here on any delay while Mr. Amaro was still representing Mr. Lewis. He didn't file that 4 month. He didn't file that motion 4 month within the 14 days, and we are not relying on that. But we are relying on the fact that Mr. Brining, the public defender, did not file a motion during the 2 months he represented Mr. Lewis. And of course, on the fact that Attorney Shearer did not file a motion until a month after his appearance. Also, in relation to excusable neglect, there was discussion about why Mr. Shearer had not filed a motion earlier. The district court asked him that, I believe, and his answer was basically his schedule. He needed time to review the record and so forth and prepare the motion. He did not, I should point out, and this also may have been mentioned earlier, he did not file a motion as he could have within that 14-day period saying, Judge, I just got on this case. Could I have more time to file this motion under Rule 33? But in relation to his statement that he needed more time because of his schedule, this court has said, this is in the case decision, neglect due to a busy schedule is generally not excusable.
On the Rule 33 issue, on the real facts, not the hypothetical facts, okay, Does it make any difference to you whether it's a chronic claim or a Strickland claim as a legal matter? The reason I'm asking you that is those are distinct claims. Okay. If there's a complete deprivation of counsel, you don't have to ask whether counsel was ineffective, right? It's structural error. Yeah. So if Ms. Green, I don't know that, it may be too late in the day to try to amend this. Okay. But it'd be possible if it's a chronic claim and it could get in under B2, that there's no subsequent 2255 bar to the Strickland claim. You see what I mean?
I see what you mean, Your Honor. Except that, I guess this is falling to the merits.
I mean, a chronic claim is a heavy lift.
Is a very heavy lift. And if
especially
you look
against
at,
the backdrop of what we know about the trial, but that's not up to us.
The chronic claim would be almost impossible, again, referring to the merits, because on the record, it looked like he did okay at trial. Your Honor, I see that my time is up. If you want, I could address the evidentiary hearing issue, but otherwise, we will ask the court to affirm the district court.
I think you can rely on your brief. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Ms. Green, we'll go back to you now for rebuttal argument.
Thank you. May it please the court. I do agree with counsel that there is a balance between finality and fairness, but finality cannot come at the expense of justice. The district court allowed us to conduct an investigation into what was happening with Mr. Amiro. That was when we discovered before trial, 11 days before trial, he had this mental impairment where he cited memory loss. He wanted to close down his practice of law, PTSD, anxiety, night terrors, etc. Because that issue has now been opened and the door has been opened to that, something has to be done. And if that means the district court allows us to actively investigate under B2, under the chronic, where we are able to maybe have an evidentiary hearing, which was already outlined, a stipulation by the parties ahead of time was prepared, so that we can get to the root of what's going on with Mr. Amiro, and then still have that avenue to preserve a 2255 under Strickland, maybe that's what needs to happen. But under these facts and under this record, it's unclear to me how we can proceed and say that finality should come before fairness.
Ms. Green, let me ask you a legal question. I'm not trying to give you a pop quiz or anything like that. I just want to know what your instinct is on this. Okay. You're very focused on the fact pattern here, which I totally understand. Are you asking us to hold as a legal matter, okay, that all ineffective assistance claims, if they're brought within that B1 time window, okay, can be considered on the merits in a new trial motion under Rule 33? In other words, what I'm asking you to do is step out of this fact pattern for a minute, because we have to resolve this case, there's no question, but we've got to think about the next case when we draft an opinion. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to figure out is, are you saying an ineffective assistance of counsel claim can be brought as a new trial motion under B1?
B1 as newly discovered evidence?
Correct. That's what I mean.
I don't think it would be
Or
hard.
Are you asking us to do something else? Forget the fact pattern for a minute.
As a purely legal matter, I don't think it should be a hard and fast rule, because there is the balance of the factors to look into when you get into the facts, which you told me to ignore.
No, I know. I you're doing a good job on the facts. I get that. Okay. So in your view, it's we should just do it case by case.
I am asking the court to hold that it's possible to bring it under B1, because as it stands right now, counsel is arguing that that's not an avenue at all, and I think that would be an inappropriate holding. It would foreclose this possibility in all cases, and that would be hard and fast.
Okay, and what do you say to Mr. Simpson saying, well, hold on, you're right to say it'd be foreclosed under Rule 33, mm-hmm. but 2255 is available.
2255 is available as an avenue, but there are still separate matters that you can get to the bottom of in the district court before you get to the 2255, like the evidentiary hearing. We have the benefit of having more facts here because the district court allowed us to investigate before denying nearly a year later. If we hadn't had that avenue, where would we be right now?
If you file a 2255, you could file it, file it right in the same court, go right back there, and you can accompany it with a request for an evidentiary hearing. Now, I don't know, it's not us, we're not the district court, but their evidentiary hearings are available in 2255 ineffective assistance of counsel proceedings. And if you want to check me on that, you can look at 2255E.
Would we still have the opportunity to have a new trial, though, if we ended up ultimately determining that the trial was...
That's going to be a question of the 2255 remedy. Okay? But it's not... All I'm trying to say, okay, is it's not as if there can... that evidentiary hearings are disallowed in 2255. No. Quite to the contrary. They're allowed, and they occur with some frequency in ineffective assistance of counsel cases. That's one of the primary reasons that our court and the Supreme Court has talked about why it's beneficial to channel ineffective assistance claims to 2255, so a factual record can get developed.
But would that foreclose our opportunity to proceed first under the Cronick standard and then under the Strickland standard?
Well, in your 2255 application, you'll include the contents that you include, whether it's Cronick, whether it's Strickland, whether it's this, whether it's that. That's a choice that Mr. Lewis's counsel will have to make.
I see I'm out of time. Did you have any other questions, Your Honor?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Green. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. The case will be taken under advisement.